And as I've been nagging you all afternoon, we have a company coming over, and it's always somebody special. We always have a great time yapping with the folks out there. And we landed my good friend Jim Bovard once again here this afternoon. I've got a number of things I need to run by him, and he was kind enough to make a hole in his schedule to join us. James, welcome back. How you doing?
Doing good. Thanks for having me on. I was shocked to read online that you're buying beer these days. Never would have expected that from you.
Well, yeah, I did. I did mention that, didn't I? I mean,
that's what I keep buying a tutu.
Wow, there's a mental picture I can use.
Please don't.
No, all right. Actually, Blue Moon? Is that what the name is?
Blue Moon.
Okay. Blue Moon. Yeah, I mean that's pretty good. I mean, it's not the hardcore stuff that you drink that you have to shave first before you can put it in a glass, but it's good stuff.
Well, I have used Blue Moon a couple times to clean my the battery terminals in my car.
Oh, it's not that strong. No, I wouldn't be drinking it. What car? Now, if you'd said your bicycle chain, now I would have had a problem.
But okay.
So you're telling me that drinking Blue Moon
It's fine. It's not bad.
Okay. It's not bad. There's a ringing endorsement for you. It's not bad.
it might help you grow brass, as Bill Clinton would say.
Oh, yeah.
Those
yeah,
people
boy.
Have some brass.
Big line last night, that old corn dog. Did you suffer through that performance?
Well, you know, it was kind of a funny thing. I was working late. I kind of had a bit of a headache, so I went out for a long walk, came back in, flipped the TV screen on. He was just starting. And, you know, so it was good timing because I saw the whole speech. And Bill Clinton is the smoothest liar in American politics.
Boy, and you ought to know, because you wrote a book called "Feeling Your Pain," not long after we met, and it was kind of an interesting and insightful look at the Clinton administration and Clinton himself and all the rest. I've got the entire Bovard library, as you probably know, and I was it's kind of curious. What do you think? I mean, did you ever meet him? That's what I thought.
No, I was not invited to the White House. It was interesting seeing how the media portrayed him and how the folks viewed him, because he was treated like some wise elder statesman, when in reality, Clinton exploited and expanded the dictatorial potential of the U.S. presidency. And Clinton's clearest legacy was the principle of government supremacy. And so it's understandable why Clinton would love Obama, because they're basically two of a kind, and George W. wasn't that different. So in a lot of ways, we're sort of like in the fifth term of the Bill Clinton presidency, as far as the idea that government should be above the law, that the president is some great wise leader who should be permitted to do whatever good deeds he thinks are good for the country or good for his image. And there was just this blind faith in the coercive power of the best and brightest. So many of Clinton's schemes show that, and Obama's the same type.
But yesterday or the day before?
Joe Biden.
I'm sorry?
Joe Biden.
No, I just hear his voices. Maybe I just read something, but my understanding was that the relationship between the Obamas and the Clintons are very much akin to the Hatfields and the McCoys, and that it is and it's deep, and so on. So it makes you wonder how or why it would be that somebody like Clinton would come out and do what he did for someone who, as Ed Klein related in that one incident, Clinton referred to him as the amateur.
Well, I think Bill Clinton didn't have a lot of other opportunities this week. and he's someone who just loves being in front of an audience and loves to be telling them how wonderful his own presidency was. There was a wonderful series of Twitter messages by the Onion website yesterday. If people dip onto Twitter, it's worth looking at. But Clinton always had an ego that was larger than the planet Jupiter. And this gave him a chance to strut. But Clinton is a hell of a good speaker, and it's interesting. It's sad to think what kind of opportunities that the GOP lost last week, because most of the people who appeared there were showcased there, were, you know, spent their time talking about their difficult childhoods, or as Mitt Romney told us, sometimes he had to work on weekends when he was raising five sons.
Wow.
And I'm kind of thinking, like, you know, there's some folks I know who haven't worked on weekends.
Yeah, and there are people who are working 7 days a week who don't have any kids. You know, there's all of that.
But it was just, it was sad that the GOP chose not to put any kind of, to put so little spotlight on its ideas. Whereas you had Bill Clinton out there, very deceptive, but still a very effective, you know, almost Reagan-esque as far as his ability to explain things and to carry an audience along on a policy speech that was actually a lot more complex than what you normally hear on national TV.
Well, that is true, and I flipped around right after it was over because I wanted to catch as many of the early comments as I could, usually the unguarded ones from the blow-dried set that we're going to be doing the critiquing, and what I heard most was, well, that'll be keeping the fact checkers busy all week, you know, and that kind of business. Which, I don't know how true that might be, but there was an awful lot of snake oil in a lot of the things that that he said.
Absolutely. I mean, this is Bill Clinton. Clinton was always a rascal. He's someone who dealing straight would be almost unnatural. And part of the reason that Clinton, I think, did that last night was he's trying to build up his own legacy and perhaps trying to help boost his wife's chance to become president in 2016. But it wasn't like he was being generous. I mean, that's not in his blood.
No, and that's kind of interesting too, because that was a conversation that we had the other day. There's based on a number of people writing on the supposition or the possibility or whatever that's what that was all about. That he wanted to remind everybody how great everything was when he was president, and how great they did things when he was in charge. And yeah, go ahead and vote for Obama because whatever. When I was, you know, and so on. Because it's not 2012 that he's interested in. It's that last shot that they're going to get in 2016 when Hillary can give it another poke.
Yeah, I think that may have been part of it, but Bill Clinton loves being in front of an audience, loves a TV camera, and, you know, it's interesting to see how, you know, back in the early 1990s, he was an okay speaker, but he's someone who improved a lot during the time he was president as a public speaker, which is a lot better than Obama has done or George W. did. And he's just, you know, he has a knack for working an audience, which is rare these days.
Yeah, that is true. That is true. And I wonder, you know, you got to wonder how the president was feeling backstage, listening to this guy play the audience like a Stradivarius, and he's going to come out there with the with his friend tell a prompter, and have to and go through that without nearly. Of course, everybody said he was a great speaker and soaring oratory and so on, but he still looks like an amateur compared to somebody like Clinton.
I agree. But flip side is, I think a lot of people are going to be comparing Obama not to Clinton, but to Mitt Romney. Mitt Romney's speech last week was a lot better than he normally does, but it was like, you know, it's sad to think that the GOP is trying to capture the presidency based on their family history. You know, because I don't give a rat's patootie about the family history. I mean, if it was really, you know, if there was a huge amount of drama, well, it's funny that Marco Rubio was still there, because for a while he had by far the best family history about how his parents fled once Castro took over, and he landed in Florida with nothing. And then it turned out his parents left Cuba a few years before Castro took over. So I put a hell of a dent in his story.
Yeah, that. But, you know, it's like anything else. You know, these fact checkers will come out and they'll say that Clinton was wrong on this and overblown on that and undershot on something else. But that message will never reach the number of people that he reached given that speech last evening. Same thing with Romney. You know, whatever the fallen ratings are for conventions in general over the years, it's like anything else. You know, you have a blazing front page headline story, and they put the corrections back by the used car ads.
Yeah, that's a very nice way to put it. Well, it was disappointing. Well, I mean, it's unfortunate. I think Romney's economic ideas would in general be better than Obama's. Romney seems to have this weird idea that it'd be a good idea to have a conflict with Russia. Maybe he's not aware that they actually still have quite a few missiles. Mm. And plus, he's always saber-rattling for war against Iran, which would do wonders for the price of oil and the number of military cemeteries here. There's a number of things that he just kind of seems clueless on, or else, I don't know if it's partly his Mormon, worldview or what, but it's strange.
Yeah, I think the Mormon thing. I had the chance to interview him twice, both at CPAC and
What was your impression?
And he was unfortunately he didn't stick around for you to show up. That would have been worthwhile.
Okay. Well, yeah, he's from Massachusetts. I lived in Massachusetts. I never forgive.
In fact, I remember the first time I interviewed him. It's like at CPAC, unless you're Jim Bovard, who'll be and Stephen Moore will hang around for a while. It's kind of hit it, and get it. So you've got 8 minutes, to do the best you can. So I said to him, I asked him, what do you think how your religion is going to play in this campaign? I thought we had settled that all with Kennedy and Catholicism.
Sure.
But Catholicism, Episcopalians like me, Baptists, Presbyterians, and all the rest, Jews, they're pretty much mainstream. Mormons are still looked at as, other than Donnie and Marie, kind of weird. What do you think? And, he gave a good answer. Well, I hope it wouldn't, because, I live my blah, 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 blah. But the your comment earlier about the family history, do you get the sense that the Republicans didn't want to venture forth with hardcore policy information because the Democrats were having the follow-up? They were coming in, behind them with their convention, and they didn't want to put their stuff out there just to have it ripped to shreds. It was a lot easier to let them make fun and do their thing the way it was last night give too much detail.
Yeah, I mean, it's my impression is that the GOP has not been interested in putting forward its ideas in a presidential race since 1980. Ronald Reagan did a great job of it that year. That's a major reason why he won. But ever since then, in 1988, it was George H.W. Bush, kinder and gentler. In 1996, it was Bob Dole, so he just stand there and mumbled. And George W. was just kind of a compassionate conservative doggerel. I mean, it's hard to think of when the GOP really tried to run on its ideas in the last third of a century. And maybe because they really don't have that money, or else they don't have that much faith in him, or the GOP may simply be using its various positions as a ploy to capture power, similar to what the Democrats often do.
But the deal on Republicans is that invariably they have been the wonks. They have been the pointy-headed ones. They have been the geeks, that would talk policy until their ears fell off. And Democrats were the ones who put out somebody like Clinton, who'd get you dancing in the aisles and have the snappy one-liners and all the rest. It kind of appears that they were playing to type, in the sense that this is what Republicans do. We don't get out there and talk policy and do all that wonky stuff. That'd be like Victorians talking in public about sex. They're just not going to do that.
It's frustrating to me that the Republicans are not attacking Obama on some very basic issues, such as the Obama claiming the president has a right to order the assassination of American citizens without any due process, the fact that Obama's perpetuated all these national security agency surveillance on people's emails and phone calls, the fact that Obama claims the right to intervene any place where he thinks it would do good in the world. These are the kind of issues that could be wonderful to rally people. I mean, these are some of Ron Paul's issues. And if Romney or his people had the vision, they would pick up on some of the ideas that Ron Paul used very effectively to mobilize people and fill them with enthusiasm. Instead, we're supposed to be enthused because of Romney's family history or Bain Capital or something. It's like, I think that the GOP is taking the voters for granted. And if that's what they keep doing, they're going to lose.
Well, I wouldn't. I certainly wouldn't argue against that point. But I did have an interesting conversation with G. Edward Griffin a while back, the author of the Creature from Jekyll Island, and he brought out a couple of pretty interesting points that the separation between Democrats and Republicans is so non-existent to the point where there are two or three major policy items that they don't disagree on and they will not debate. And things like foreign policy, and so they will not the banking system and so on. They're not gonna go near it. So I wonder how much of that, you know, is an outshoot of. I didn't get a chance to speak to Mr. Griffin at length on that. We're trying to arrange to get him back on, but I'm sure you're familiar with the Creature from Jekyll Island. You kind of wonder when somebody is presenting their Achilles heel to you. Why wouldn't you sink your teeth into it?
Well, it's hard to know, but the flip side is it might be that the GOP is more brain dead than people think. Because if you look at how they haven't learned anything on foreign policy in the last dozen years, because many of Romney's top foreign policy advisors were the same crew that was urging George W. to invade Iraq. So it's like, oh, well, that's they've certainly got a record. It's amazing that the people would listen to them, but they seem to have captured the Romney campaign. I don't know. I've seen so little learning curve from either political party, which is why it was disappointing to see how Romney's people treated the Ron Paul delegates. They were, it was like the that famous scene from Selma. Was it 1965 when there were the civil rights protesters? And there was some sheriff who set the dogs loose on them.
Yeah, the German Shepherds, yeah.
Yeah, and it was just appalling to see the utter contempt and degradation of those delegates who were justifiably elected and who stood for something. I mean, I think that captures the arrogance of Romney's people, and it's the same kind of arrogance which has led the GOP to loss after loss, or if they did win, they just stood for almost nothing but a bunch of, plundering. So it's hard to have much hope from either of the major parties.
Why do you suppose, especially considering the appetite that the mainstream media had for that they didn't give more exposure to that? I mean, it would have been there was no love lost on the mainstream media's part for Ron Paul. They would have done just about anything they could, I think, to try and find something on Mitt Romney. So if you have Romney's henchmen out there beating up on Ron Paul, I mean, hell, you're one shy of a trifecta.
That's a good way to put it. I don't know. I mean, I think a lot of the media just has a distrust or contempt for a lot of the values of the Ron Paul delegates and supporters, and these are folks who are fixated on freedom and don't trust the government, so there must be something wrong with them. So I think that was part of it, but I think a lot of the media folks are fairly in tight with both the campaigns. But it was, Romney's people seem to think they're going to have a 10 million vote margin, because otherwise it would make no sense to take the Ron Paul supporters and rub their nose in dirt.
You know, I'm glad you brought that up, because you reminded me of something that happened way back, over a dozen years ago. I think you'll remember this. You recommended to me, I think I was still on the air in Washington, you recommended a book to me. I believe that the topic was Polaganda.
Okay.
Do you remember that?
No.
It was written by a guy who was in the agriculture department at the time, I think you told me.
Okay.
And it was a discussion. The book was a revelation, actually, at least for me, on the way political parties and the media and so on use public opinion polls, all their polling, to drive a particular agenda.
Yeah, there's been a lot more of that since then, and it's unfortunate to see that there has not been more of a backlash against some of the obvious twists and turns, but it was more than a dozen years ago that I first started throwing around the phrase attention deficit democracy. It was probably inspired in part by Bill Clinton, by seeing the kind of lies that Clinton could get away with. And since Clinton has left office, the lies have gotten even bigger, and the public has become less attentive, shall we say. The news media seems to have become more complicit, and the adverse impact of government power has become much greater. I mean, if you look at the housing boom and bust, good Lord, and yet people still trust Fannie Mae, or still trust the Federal Reserve, or still trust HUD, and I don't know why.
Yeah, well, that's the thing. I remember, you know, because I remember after that book came out, and I talked to the guy on the air, and it was great, and then he disappeared, and I think I asked you about it, and he said he kind of just poofed from the ag department, and he was working, you know, somewhere, and took a real low profile. All of a sudden, I said, whoa, wow, you know, but it was really insightful as to how and that gets back to the business of the 10 million. Where are they getting this landslide from? You know, we talked to Fritz Wenzel here, who was Ron Paul's official pollster, you know, during the campaign. Uh-huh. And he's given the audience, you know, a lot of great information on how that all works, how you can, how you go about, you know, crafting your questions and, all the rest of that to get the results you want. And then they say, hey, look at this. Everybody loves me, not you. You know, so on. Yeah, well, but, you just asked my parents. What the hell do you expect? You know, so,
well, it's just interesting that Romney and his people don't seem to realize that they have to be able to give a positive message and positive values and ideas out there, instead of just kind of talking about how, that long riff in Romney's speech about how his father would always give his mother a rose every morning. You know, you could have been talking about freedom and talking about freedom in a way that was something aside from government power.
Yeah.
But instead we're hearing about roses from a politician who might screw us.
Yeah. Well, hopefully the wool will disappear and the gauze and all the rest of that from the eyes of the sheep.
Uh-huh. Well, you know, and, the wool is gone. Perhaps we'll need to buy the fan belt.
That's right. That's true. Well, there you go. Like I told the audience, I know we'd have a wide-ranging discussion on a lot of really interesting things, and there you have it. This guy, it's the way it is. And I always welcome the time and opportunity to sit here and yap with you on the air. Jim, thanks a lot for making room for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on. It was fun.
Well, always a pleasure. James Bovard, author of Attention Deficit Democracy, with a new book in the oven that should be out at some point.